The part of Soylent Bean will be played by Mrs. Dasmy's wife.
I hate that every series that he creates or was showrunner on sets up the promise of grand mysteries or even just coherent plot arcs, but plainly he has no idea where the story is running.
Uh-huh.
I hate that all his ideas are derivative, but unlike a competent derivative creator like Spielberg, he doesn't know to borrow things of quality and build off of them. He never succeeds at more than just naked homage and in-jokes.
Right.
I hate that he collaborates with writers who accept miracles or deus ex machina as acceptable plot devices. I mean, what the hell was that regenerative blood shit?
Meh.
You cannot undo death. If death doesn't matter in your storytelling, then nothing does. You've fully disassembled consequence. And is your story even that important? Over 90 billion people have lived and died without the benefit of reanimation in their real stories. Is having an unremarkable fistfight with Benedict Cumberbatch so important that you're willing to cancel the truest end of all tales? Miracle is not plot. When you pull that shit, it's the same as turning to your audience and saying, I couldn't be bothered to do my job. I've abandoned storytelling, and I hope you don't mind too much, but it's okay, because audience, I don't respect you anyway.
Hey guys.
Oh shit.
Hello? Snaked?
I really hope some of my garbage isn't inexplicably alive.
This doesn't look or feel like my bed of wood shavings beside your furnace. Where am I?
Well, you're wrapped up in a half dozen extra thick contractor bags and some old sheets from behind the gas station.
Why?
For structural rigidity. You were too heavy for just the contractor bags.
No, I mean why. Why in a sense that makes me understand what's happening.
Because we were on our way to the neighborhood medical incinerator out in the woods, but now... Are you alive in there?
Yes, everything was dark and then I saw a flash of light and this is wonderful, I can resume my life.
Well, maybe for another 15 minutes. This was actually an illegal body disposal, but now I'm afraid it's just also an illegal murder.
What? Why?
You have to die, Dasmy, for the sake of narrative.
What?
I can't let you live. If I did, I'd be committing the far worse crime of creating an impossible situation and then not bothering to write a resolution.
Do we have any old business other than the fact that I am alive again?
Yay!
Everyone. I live.
Yeah, that really warms my heart.
I got nothing. Just that we've dwindled down our movie viewings to 3 nights a week, and I am completely fucking sick of movies. So why don't we move on to new business?
So, Snaked, if you're tired of movies, what should we talk about? This is a podcast where we review, pop culture and movies and music and TV and science fiction. What are we going to talk about if you don't want to watch any more movies?
Well, I have an idea. A cunning plan, if you will. You know how humans have been exchanging their stories for at least tens of thousands of years, if not longer, going back to the beginning of spoken language?
I am aware of this, yes.
Yeah, a lot of people are, actually. Well, it seems that a few times over the course of the history of our species, we've developed the ability to record information by means of written notation. And people started putting their stories into clay tablets when this happened. So my thought was, we could talk about one of those.
Like the Ten Commandments, or... So there's this more recent one. It's a type of written notation story where they use this thing called paper instead of clay. It's made with trees.
Well,
and it's infinitely more portable and easier to deal with.
I could probably get more of those into a backpack, and that's also really good because my cuneiform is a bit rustic.
Okay, well, what I have in mind is this thing called a screenplay, but instead of making a movie out of it, they just basically show the script to the audience. So you don't have to watch the movie. We can read the movie.
We just read the movie. I know those. Paper. They used to come out once a month, and they tell women that they're fat.
That is correct.
So, hey, audience. Today we're going to be talking about Neuromancer, the 1984 sci-fi tale by William Gibson, which is often recalled as the founding piece establishing the cyberpunk genre. This is probably one of those needs-no-introduction pieces. But this is going to be kind of a funny conversation because Dasmi and I both recently listened to the 2003 BBC radio production of Neuromancer. And between the two of us, I have read the novel, and I don't believe Dasmi's cram session included that.
It did not, unfortunately.
So it's I think we're going to be talking about both pieces while I get my wires really, really mixed up between the two of them.
All right. For those of our audience who aren't familiar with it, we should probably introduce some of the pieces of the story and our main characters. Neuromancer tells the story of Case, a console cowboy, which is an early term for hacker that didn't quite endure in fiction, whose previous employer has chemically damaged him such that he can no longer connect to cyberspace. So he's purposeless, despondent, suicidal in a callous, endless city. He's approached by Molly, who I guess I would describe as being like a back alley problem solver of fortune and seasoned in the ways of this setting. As the story begins, she's the hired right hand of a mysterious stranger, Armitage, and he's got a job, and they're putting together a crew. What it is, we don't quite know right away, but in a world of scheming computer AIs and high intrigue right down to the gutter, we might make some reasonable guesses. So, let me begin by throwing this question to you, Dasmi. Did the plot make any sense to you?
Yes. only because I'm familiar with the cyberpunk genre in general.
Okay.
So, yes, it did. But I think if I had come to it, like, if you had my mom read it, it would not have made any sense. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right, right. This was something that jumped out to me when I sat down with the radio drama. I don't feel like the narrative was well preserved, going from the book to the radio piece. And I think I'm actually okay with that for the most part, because my feeling is that Neuromancer and also its genre is more about the aesthetic presentation of storytelling rather than narrative storytelling, which is pretty typical of its genre. It's showing us pictures and taking us of a tour of looks and feelings rather than focusing on clearly communicating a story with a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It reminded me a lot of the narration of the movie Sin City.
Oh, sure.
It's kind of like an old-time radio drama with computers in Sin City, if you've seen that movie.
Right, right. Wait, and that was an episodic narration where everything comes together at the end.
Yep.
Yeah. I think you might get kind of an episodic vibe out of the story, just because the characters are rich enough that when they get the spotlight, you feel the strength of the narrative thread that they're sitting on top of, even if the narrative underneath them is a little bit meandering.
It was a little bit meandering. Is the book that way, or is it just the adaptation?
No, actually, the book is stronger in its storytelling. The radio drama had to abridge quite a bit, and I think they did that for reasons of more than just fitting into a 2-hour running time, as opposed to, I suppose, the audiobook must be something like 12 hours.
So it was a little bit meandering, and it was, I had to listen to parts a couple times to make sure I was following the story. And I think that's because they, like you said, they kind of abridged quite a bit of it.
Right.
So I needed to go back and just give it another listen to make sure I understood what setting we were in and who was doing what.
Yeah. I think the best example that I can come up with of something that got snipped for the radio drama is Molly's background. In a story that's about cool characters, Molly is my favorite character in the story. But in the radio drama, she comes across as a very generic, strong female sidekick who's really the hero. They deleted a lot of her. So in the book, she's similarly set up as a mysterious femme fatale. And she's differently in the book. She's almost immediately sexually available to Case in a way that initially might be written to be seen as gratifying to like a 14-year-old comic book reader.
Sure.
But she's more complex than that. So like the other characters in the story, she's a wounded soul. Somewhere in, it's probably in the third quarter of the book, she recalls an old boyfriend with whom she had what she would probably consider an idyllic arrangement of romance and material contentment. And he's taken from her with quiet violence. And also, the introduction that I mentioned where she is immediately connected with Case, physically connected, that makes sense later on in the book when she gives a little bit more background describing her time working as what's called a meat puppet in the story. That's a prostitute who's given a brain augmentation that prevents the formation of memories while she's on the clock.
Super handy.
So, right. So she's using the job to pay for body augments. And there's probably something to unpack there about selling one's body to remake it. She says it's good money, but that sometimes you wake up a bit sore.
Jesus.
And and as a bit of nightmare fuel, she says that the other augments, the memory suppressing ones, the new augments, as they started to accumulate in her body, the memory suppressing one begins to fail. So she's not just this willing wench who throws herself at the protagonist. Really, she's the one getting what she wants out of Case. She's in control, and she's clever enough to let Case feel like he's making decisions. I mean, there's real affection there, but this is all very pragmatic stuff. And she's just too worldly for kid stuff like true love and uses sex as a means to an end here.
True love. Nobody needs that true love shit anyway.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're a married man. You know better. So anyway, when you sum it all up, Molly has as much of a chip on her shoulder as anyone else in the whole gang of lunatics. But it's, I guess it's a demonstration of the strength of her as a character that despite that, she's the most grounded one. Mm-hmm. So stepping away from the literary version of Molly, I think was both out of necessity of, you know, you got to cut something else. And also there was quite a bit of puritanical rinsing of the story in the radio drama.
I was wondering about that since it aired on the BBC on the radio. I was wondering if they smoothed out some of the rough edges.
There was that. And also you may recall a scene where Riviera, the psychopath, is giving this dinner theater psycho hallucination performance.
Yes.
And he uses Molly as part of it. And in the book, it is so much more sexually charged.
Okay. Yeah. I was wondering if they toned that down a bit.
They knocked it down to about a minute or so in the drama, and they really cleaned it up.
I'm going to order the book because I need to read it to feel like I understand the radio version better.
That, I think, is a point that I'm going to be making a few times over the course of this conversation.
You talked about the meat puppets, and I can't remember the term they used for it, but there's also the term for, what was it? When Case is able to control Molly's body, basically, and see through her eyes and, you know, feel what she's feeling. What the hell did they call it when you could do that with celebrities? As kind of a voyeuristic living through the eyes of a celebrity kind of thing?
Oh, it was meat something.
Yeah.
Something about meat.
Yeah, I was like, holy shit, we're very nearly there with, you know, I don't want to sound like an old man, but, you know, like following celebrities on Instagram and living vicariously through them. It felt very, very 2020, especially in the midst of the pandemic we're in right now, where like escapism, you want to live through someone else who's having a better life than you. It just reminded me of that.
Yeah, I mean, this story, I should say, because we're not just talking about the book, but this story, it predicts a lot of our modern world, or so it would seem at first glance. But when we go back to classic sci-fi like this, I often wonder how much is being predicted in the story as opposed to how much is being recalled and imitated by the real engineers and forward-thinking minds of the world for whom sci-fi is probably one of their formative genres.
Yeah, I'm sure it's both. It reminds me, it brought me back to some of the games I used to play as a kid, kind of like, do you remember Spectre VR on the Mac?
I sure do.
That was kind of a cyberpunky, you know, jack into the Matrix kind of game. It reminded me of that. I tried to find a PDF copy of it, but there was some literature that came with the box set. There was like a cyberpunk story that went along with the game. And I was so trying so hard to find it, but I couldn't find it because it reminded me a lot of that.
Was that a System Shock?
Maybe.
Okay. And for those of you who don't know, Spectre was a kind of a Battle Zone style game that came out on the Macintosh and used these line vector graphics where you're situated in a black world with just a simple color gradient on the horizon, and your tanks are drawn just in wireframes. And the look and feel of it is a lot like the Tron arcade game if you were playing it from like a first person perspective.
Yep. Yeah. It gave me that cyberpunk nostalgia feel from when I was a kid and when the internet was still something like, it wasn't something entirely pervasive. It was something you had to sit down and physically connect to. And it reminded me of that nostalgic feeling as a kid of like, you know, they use the term jacking into cyberspace, which today sounds hilarious, but you know, as a kid, you'd sit down and like, you'd have to log in and you'd have to play, like you'd have to physically do something to get on the internet. It wasn't all pervasive. It was like a separate, it felt like a separate world back then, which is what.
Well, you know, just as an aside, I think we're sort of returning to that in some of our video gaming.
Yeah.
With VR headsets coming out, you got to climb into that system. You got to pull something down in front of your face.
Yeah.
And so there's a ritual that precedes your mind entering the game world now.
Yeah, definitely. As an aside on your aside, I tried VR for the first time a couple months ago in my brother's office.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to, so I picked up this ball in the game or in the environment.
Yeah.
And I decided I was going to toss it. So I tossed it, but I didn't have the strap on. So I threw the controller across his office and bounced it off his monitors. Because it convinces your brain you're in there. It's weird.
One of my first VR experiences after I had jacked into cyberspace. I don't like saying that. Anyway. Oh, yeah.
Get my Duke Nukem voice.
Hey, John St. John, if you're listening, we'd love to have you on the show.
Yes, we would. Anyway. Absolutely. I would love to interview you about Duke Nukem and how that was recording that.
Or whatever other projects you got going on, man.
Absolutely.
Anyway, this was a first-person shooter done in the Unreal Engine, and it's just a wave shooter. I think the enemies are even like the default Unreal editor or robot or whatever it is. But in VR, when you're aiming a handgun, it feels an awful lot like aiming a handgun. And when your body kinematics have real input into the game, you're jumping up and down, you're rolling around in the room, you're diving for cover. And the first time I was in there, I broke a sweat and it was incredible.
Yeah. That's the environment that Case jacks into, basically, is it's VR, essentially.
Right. It's connected VR.
Right.
And, you know that the big social media companies are thinking about, well, hey, how can we recreate this cyberspace thing from 80s sci-fi and put ads in it?
It's so connected that sometimes he dies a little bit. It's that connected to his physiology.
That I loved that little bit of the world building, where so this came out at a point in time that I think we as a modern audience have a little bit of trouble connecting with where a contemporary audience would have seen some of the sci-fi. Like when we go back to the sci-fi classics, the knowledge of how to operate a computer was something that was esoteric. Mm-hmm. And that ability was basically its own character attribute. Like Uhuru, she was a smarty because she knew what button to push.
Right.
But when you're writing for an audience where a computer might just be like a distant aspirational item that you read about in popular electronics or something that you saw fleetingly that day you went to your dad's office, the story has to abstract the use of a computer in a way that you can build a story around. And I think that's close to the similar for a the challenge for a modern audience, because watching a guy enter text into a command line just isn't that interesting any longer. You know, because that's part of your job.
Yeah. It's why they had to make Swordfish, you know, the movie Swordfish. It's why they had to make all the computer interfaces on there all like 3D and hackery with throbbing techno music.
Unix. I know this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Because if you're really just like, I'll unlock the doors from this terminal, it's not, you can't build a story around some dude typing unlock _ door or whatever.
Right. But anyway, I liked the imagery of the computer interactions in this.
Yeah.
It's service to the two problems that I just outlined. I liked that Dixie Flatline, who is like Case's hacker mentor, describes AI both in terms of its non-literal appearance and also its feeling. And as you point out, interacting with one can result in real physical trauma. And that's so cool because it ups the stakes to being a console cowboy, which is a term that really didn't take off. Hacker is similar to stepping out onto like a physical battlefield.
Right. Yeah. It's also clear that the Wachowski brothers we're familiar with this when they wrote The Matrix.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because they're definitely jacking in, and it's life and death peril in there. This story, I felt like, did a better job of communicating the physical risk, because they just show it as something that can happen. Dixie Flatline got his nickname because his heart stopped a few times while he was in some system, as opposed to when The Matrix lampshaded this with Morpheus just saying, well, the mind makes it real.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's not just the mind making it real. It's the actual physical connection to your body. I guess you could say.
World building like that was really cool. When you write in this genre, a lot of what you're doing is you're exhibiting your world building notebook, because this is a genre where, building off of what other people have done so far is pretty much expected, but you got to expand upon it. And, even without a lot of shoulders to stand on when Gibson created, this particular story, it was written in a way where so much of the detail of the world was fleshed out and presented very casually to the reader or the listener, that there's a lot to pick up on if you're a close observer. I loved details like, one of the two main AIs in the story, Wintermute, that it has limited Swiss citizenship.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Limited in quotes. And of course, it's also Swiss.
Yeah, it's absolutely
citizenship.
The Swiss, yeah.
Right. And I love that the company that owns this thing, is run by a family that's constantly in and out of hibernation in between cloning sessions, and a whole bunch of lawyers have to keep track of who's been cloned and who's currently awake and actually running things.
Yeah, it's a fascinating world he's created.
Right.
It's interesting to note that that William Gibson actually coined the term cyberspace. The term didn't exist before him, which is fascinating that he was able to come up with that entire concept and build a world around it like that. It's pretty amazing.
Oh, sure.
Especially in 1981 or whenever this was.
And think of the condition of computers at the time. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I think the IBM PC was still a year or two away.
Yeah, you had the Apple II probably. I don't know if they had the two E. I think it was the two. So it was not computers were not graphical. There was no VR. You know, there was some high end stuff that could do simple animations. But there was nothing like it is now. So yeah, the person's interface with a computer, if they had one, and most people didn't have one, was text on a green or amber screen, and that was it.
Absolutely. You know, this was a time where, If you had a homemade 8-bit computer and you could really make it sing, or you had an Altair 8800, forget those Apple II guys. You were hot shit.
And let's be honest, it was better.
I think there's something to be said about the learning and practice of primitive skills, and I do believe that extends to the computing world as well.
Yeah, I agree. We don't have to get into that, though. I'm a computer Luddite, but we don't have to.
It's only a matter of time before our IRC community actually has its own BBS.
Right, exactly.
And yes, you really will have to dial into it after you jack in, of course.
Yes, you have to jack in. I don't want anybody in our IRC channel jacking in anywhere near me. Join us in IRC, by the way. Go to skiffy.club.
We're going to have a lot of fun with that pun.
Yeah. Come to our IRC channel, skiffy.club. There's a web interface. It's a good time.
If you think this is bad, there's a lot more of it there.
There's a lot of jacking in.
Yeah. So I've been talking about world building, but I think a lot of the world building going on in stories of this era, Neuromancer and the other novels and movies that were coming out around the same time, are something that a modern audience is going to connect to differently than a contemporary one.
Yeah, I think so.
But in I'll tell you what I mean. Cyberpunk is a genre that takes the urban decay of the 60s, 70s, and 80s and puts it into a near future, often too near for the timeline to make sense, and then it pessimistically romanticizes the results. And given the material that we're starting from, those stories are mostly going to be cast from people outside of polite society, you know, low-level criminals, drug addicts, prostitutes and their pimps, street fixers, that kind of thing.
IRC users. And
yes, proto-IRC users, yeah. Definitely. But, you know, people of our age don't necessarily, unless they're like from Flint or Detroit, have a firsthand recollection of a lot of that. And we look at that imagery not with like a personal connection, but again, like an aesthetic one. And it surprises me just how enduring that is.
Yeah, I think even if you don't have a personal recollection or experience with it, you could look at you could put yourself in those shoes. You can look at like the urban sprawl in, I don't know, Hong Kong or someplace like that, or Los Angeles, wherever, just a huge city except with cyberpunk jacking in. I think you can kind of imagine what they're going for.
Yeah, but you know, even the cities that we walk through now, for a lot of fans of the genre, those pieces just aren't there. Like, for the part of the country where I'm from, Boston famously had what was called the Combat Zone, which was known as kind of the trashy part of the city where all the strip clubs and adult bookstores were. And that was where the prostitutes were out walking. And also due to the time, you know, since it was also home to what we might call marginalized groups, if you fell into the LGBT character, if you fell into the LGBT world, that's the space that it inhabited, mm-hmm. because it was the space for the marginalized population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Colorado Springs is an area that's, yeah, it's similar. Every city has that area.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of these places slowly vanished, mm-hmm. in the early and mid-90s. Such that the part of the city that I'm talking about now is an extension of Chinatown, has a lot of desirable real estate. It's a place where you might enjoy picking up dinner before you finish your shopping or go off to a show.
Mm-hmm. See, in the Neuromancer environment, the gentrification has moved into space. So instead of gentrifying the ghettos, they build themselves orbitals, is what they call them.
Right. Your gated community is now a space station.
Yes.
One thing, you don't even need a doorman any longer.
Right. One thing another modern audiences may not even be able to connect with is how when they open the radio drama, Case says the sky above the port is the color of a TV on a dead channel. And it just occurred to me, there's people.
So that's a bright blue sky.
Yeah, bluish gray. Yeah, but there's people here who wouldn't, alive now, who wouldn't, like if my daughter, she's 6 months, but if she listens to this in 15 years, she probably won't know what that means.
Right,
which is weird. I don't know where I was going with that. It just struck me when I heard it.
So for a future audience, or even a young present day audience, looking back at that visual description, I mean, it connects to something that you and I know, but I think that's going to fall into an example of esoteric knowledge where it's kind of cool that you know what TV static is.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Even if it's something that you had to go to whatever ends up displacing YouTube to see an example of.
Just, I can hear your roosters in the background.
I know.
Yeah, so you're going to look up on YouTube, what did TV static look like?
Right.
The general aesthetic of the whole story is something that modern audiences wouldn't necessarily... I mean, people our age and older, maybe not even older. People our age, I think, in the window of time when we were born, with the computers we grew up with the games, with the idea that computers were still something that not everybody had access to, I think we understand and maybe have some nostalgia for that whole aesthetic, but I think people older than us and people younger than us won't have it. I don't think they'll get the, I don't know, the vibe won't make any sense to them, I don't think.
I think to be fully present in a story like this one, you need to have a memory of Net Day.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing I think is other movies and, well, movies specifically have tried to pull off the same vibe and aesthetic. And I'm thinking specifically of Hackers. And it was,
oh God,
it was shit. You can really get this wrong. Gibson, by the way, the supercomputer in Hackers is called the Gibson, which is probably exactly what they were.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Awareness of something in Hackers. Yeah.
But it's pretty crazy how you can have two different extremes. You have the Matrix that got it really right, and then Hackers, which was just awful. You can, it's a fine line between being with this cyberpunk jacking in environment aesthetic. It's a fine line between being stupid and cheesy and doing it really, really well.
Right.
And I think it's easy to err on the side of shitty. Go see Hackers. It's terrible.
Oh, man. You know, I think this will endure better than you're expecting. And the reason for that is that I think about... So to me, the tech in a story like this is, you know, oftentimes it will inform the story itself, like with the AI. But a lot of it is also, I don't want to say window dressing, but I'm going to say window dressing. You know, the computer fills the same type of space as the neon lights on the skyline.
Yeah.
But going beyond that thematically, a lot of this is concerned with life in a city that's part of a world that isn't delivering on its promises. The city is, well, the cities, I mean, there are multiple cities in this, but I'm just going to speak generically and say that the city becomes kind of its own character with its own sense of melancholy resting over everything. And it's a place where you can be lonely in a crowd. Mm. And the characters within it are people who are separated from the highlighted regions of society as, again, marginalized people, and they're creating a separate world that's accessible by them. Yes. And you sprinkle in a little bit of transhumanism on top of all of that.
Yes.
I think those are really enduring themes. Because, you know, if you've ever been 15 years old, you can connect with an awful lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that is some of the point of our IRC channel. I don't think any of us are super marginalized in society, but it is a place where we hang out with people who get stories like this. And I think that's a big part of any community, is hanging out with people who just have a similar taste, similar outlook on life, similar experiences. I think that's a big part of the community that we've built.
Sure.
I know way back in the beginning when you and I first met as young low-end Mac users. Yeah, everybody can connect with feeling isolated at some point in their lives. And like you said, these people feel disconnected from the better things in life, from the opportunities in life. they even mention the holographic show that Riviera puts on. Mm-hmm. Molly mentions that the food they're eating is real, that they had to raise a cow or raise an animal for years to make it, and it's super expensive. They're even disconnected from real food.
And yeah. So
they feel separated, yeah. And they are separated from the good things in society.
Right.
And so, yes, they have their underworld, kind of, where it's a place where they belong, where they feel connected with people that understand them.
And the story doesn't even need to describe what type of soylent and impossible burgers they've been slurping up leading to that moment.
And they refer to it as vat grown, which is interesting because they also refer to some people as vat grown later in the story. So lots of shit gets grown in vats.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if that was intended to be presented as a like a literal thing, or if it was like a little piece of slang that emerges organically within the high quality world building going on.
That's true. It could be either way.
Because something that this story does, and that then became very typical of the style, is that you know how a narrative can begin in media res, like the story is already going on. In this story, it's like the culture is already going on.
Yes.
In a lot of sci-fi, the narrative voice will step back and explain how the new gizmo works. This story introduces new cultural elements and doesn't bother to explain. You're either hip or you're not.
Yes. That's why I say people who are younger or older than us probably won't get those references, just because they've never been exposed to some of those things that we were as kids. Or not even things, ideas, concepts.
Right.
Fantasy concepts. But, like the idea that you could, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s when I was a kid, the idea that I could put on electrodes or a helmet and really like drive my Spectre VR tank for real was mind-blowing. You know, it would have been the coolest thing ever.
Right.
And I don't think...
Well, hey, you weren't that old when the Virtual Boy came out.
No, but it was crap. Come on. No, at the time it was awesome, but you know what I mean, right? For someone younger, for a teenager today, virtual reality is a thing that they may not have ever used it, but they're aware of it. It's normal. You know, 3D environments are normal.
Right.
But for us as a kid, they were possible, but we didn't have access to them, and it was something you kind of... It was a cool thing you aspire to, and yeah, I don't know where I'm going with this stuff, but I think you understand what I'm saying.
We were in far enough that we could imagine that being an eventual destination.
Yes, and the concept of being
we're also a little bit younger than the contemporary audience when this book came out, so we had the benefit of seeing Wolfenstein 3D and Doom, and I'm going to say Marathon, even though none of our listeners know what that is, but you know what I'm talking about. And we could imagine those quasi 3D worlds as being places that we could step into eventually.
Yes, eventually, someday. Yeah, it was possible.
Yeah. So, you know, you talk about an audience's ability to connect through these things, and I gotta wonder if it matters a whole lot when so many of other elements of the story and the subcultures within it are presented with no explanation or justification. They're here, they're present. Deal with it.
No, I don't think it matters as far as enjoyment of the story or following what's going on, because the other themes that we've spoken about, feeling disconnected, things like that, everybody can relate with, whether or not they have any concept of cyberpunk or any nostalgic memories of that, you know, genre or world.
Okay. And also I think this is a genre that has had, it's a surprisingly young genre, but it's one that continues with strength, into the present day. And as we continually revisit it, Cyberpunk 2077 is coming out, I think, later this year, something like that. It's going to be aware of a present day audience and is going to make the adjustments needed to share a world like this with that audience. I have to imagine that the parts of stories like this that we feel wishy-washy about are going to benefit from a bridge between it and other media that targets today's audiences and tomorrow's audiences as more and more media comes out. Like, I think there might be a gentle slope that draws a thread through the whole genre's history.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think the genre is prime for a comeback just because the technology we have now, we've reached a point where quote unquote jacking in is nearly possible. You know, you've got Google Glass, things like that. You've got Elon Musk and his stupid brain implant idea. You know, the Internet of Things is coming, and one of the things is likely to be us. You know what I mean? You've got the Apple Watch that monitors your vitals. If you're diabetic, there's things that can monitor your blood sugar. So we as humans are becoming connected in kind of the same way that Case was in the story, except now it's not as dystopian and gritty. But I think the genre is prime for a comeback because our technology is now at a point where we're kind of on the cusp of becoming what he was doing.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, right. I mean, the human element of the story hasn't changed at all.
Right.
You can feel as perfectly alienated in 2020 as you could in 1980. When did this come out? 1982.
Especially 2020.
Right. 1984. Excuse me.
Yeah.
But the shape of the smartphone changes.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. And you know, the technology changes, and the variations of it that we predict are going to have somewhat different consequences on society. And if you as an author can look forward a little bit and follow those threads and imagine those consequences, cyberpunk lives on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think even the orbitals where the rich people escape to, there's even talk of that now with rich people buying bunkers around the world. And then you've got people, you know, I've read some articles recently just theorizing that in the near future, the ultra wealthy will escape to orbital colonies or space stations or Mars, you know, the relatively near future, you know what I'm saying? So that concept.
See, I just buy a mountain and build a moat around it.
There you go.
I like trees too much.
Well, it's Terraform Mars, but the concept of the rich escaping is not new. Escaping the unwashed masses is not new. And I think it's something that in 2020 people can relate to again.
I think so. And the whole class struggle thing is a story as old as revolution.
Yeah.
I was trying to unweave the history of the genre prior to Neuromancer, and I actually don't consider Neuromancer to be the founding piece, but we might get into that in a moment. It occurred to me Metropolis mm-hmm. is very much an example of a cyberpunk film. It's got the urban plight thing. It's got the transhumanism thing going on. The merging of, man, or in this case, woman, in technology. And it came out in 1927.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The technology has changed, but the concept is not new, I guess.
Right. And in that, you know, the difference between the rich off in their space stations and the rich up in the physical upper strata of the city, right, as opposed to, you know, down in the street level slums where the cool kids are hanging out. That's a pretty one-to-one comparison.
It is.
Spread out, you know, almost 60 years.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was, Gibson was definitely tapping into not new ideas. You know, these concepts are kind of core to the human experience. Disconnectedness, being left behind, the living in a perfect capitalist dystopia where everybody is left behind, you know, and there's a few people in control. Not to get too political, but, you know.
Yeah, okay. All right.
I mean, because in Neuromancer, it seems like you can buy anything. You know, you can buy augmentations. You can buy time in a celebrity's body. So everything is commodified to the
point where... Buy yourself a new liver.
Yeah, exactly. Right. People are commodified to the point where you can purchase time in someone else's body because their life is better than yours.
Well, I think... I don't think that's just the economic structure of mainstream society within the story. That also speaks to the quality of the street fixers, the people who might reasonably be expected to say, hey, we're down here at street level in Metropolis, we ought to rise up. Well, they're also making a version of that industry available to each other.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's some of that going on. So, something that I wanted to talk about with the history of the genre is, what Neuromancer borrows from and, you know, the urban dystopian mess goes at least as far back to, Metropolis. Do androids dream of electric sheep? The Philip K. Dick story was 1968, and then he did A Scanner Darkly, the novel, not the movie, in 1977. And there seems to be some genre osmosis spilling into Neuromancer from there. But looking back at this, I was surprised at how much seemed to come from movies. Blade Runner actually came out before Neuromancer by 2 years.
Oh, yeah, I guess it did.
Yeah. Akira, the comic, came out the same year. And also, you may remember when we as a community watched Escape from New York together about a year ago, I was kind of giggling about the plot point in that movie where Snake Plissken, the protagonist, has a couple of little small explosives embedded by the arteries in his neck, mm-hmm. and it forms a literal ticking clock to yes. advance the story. And I was thinking, oh, well, Neuromancer had that. Good job, movie. Escape from New York came out before Neuromancer. I didn't realize that at the time.
Really?
Yeah, it did. So wow, okay. in Neuromancer, there's the ticking clock where Case, the protagonist, has some kind of toxin implanted in his throat. And the story is propelled forward based upon that.
Huh. You're right. It did. Crazy. I didn't realize it came out before.
Yeah, so little details like that. I don't consider Neuromancer to be the foundation of the genre, but certainly a big part of its organization.
The actor in this radio drama who played Case, his name is John Shrapnel, which is the best name ever.
I didn't even pick up on that.
John Shrapnel. So, yes,
there's no IMDb page for a radio drama, so how can I possibly know these things?
There should be. Ooh, website idea.
Hey.
Yes, Gibson, you know, he coined the term cyberspace, and he did sort of organize a lot of these ideas, like you were saying.
Uh-huh.
That's all I wanted to say. It took me that long to come up with it.
Okay. Thank you for summarizing my verbal work, Dasmi.
Yes. I'm here to summarize what you say and then pass it off as my own original ideas.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you can make any of that happen in editing. something I want to inform our audience, a little bit of sausage making here. When Dasmi goes in and edits all the horrible ums and uhs and awkward silences in our recordings, he also edits out him laughing at me and my persuasion of humor.
I do.
You don't...
So whenever he makes it funny, asshole, I laugh, and then I cut it and I replace it with 10 seconds of awkward silence and me just going like, okay.
Oh man.
Just a sniff.
We need a live studio audience.
We could do that. That'd be fun actually.
So Dasmi, you're kind of an interesting test case here in that you only took in the radio drama and not the book. So I'll pass it to you. Do you recommend Neuromancer, the radio drama?
I do recommend it. There is a little bit of cheese factor to it, and I think that is unavoidable when you're adapting something like this to radio, or to any kind of film or media, because in a book you can spend a lot more time explaining, and the characters' voices are your own. Do you know what I'm saying? So you're not, your enjoyment of the story and your perception of it is not at the mercy of the voice actors. And the voice actors were all good. But what am I trying to say? Yes, I recommend it. Just be prepared that some of the terminology, like jacking in, besides the obvious joke. I mean,
I'm still giggling.
But there's a there's one scene in the movie where there's a scene in the, not the movie, the drama, where Molly asks Kay says, if you'll excuse me, and Molly says, you're going to sleep, and Kay says, no, I'm going to jack in. So that's funny. But besides the obvious joke, the term jacking in, yeah, it's hilarious. But
it's fucking
besides
hilarious.
The term jacking in is a little cheesy in 2020, but you have to put the story in the context of when it was written. So yeah, I absolutely do recommend it. Just,
right.
Let that shit go and just enjoy it for what it is. It was well acted. I think the sound design was interesting. I liked it. It was good.
I liked a lot of that as well. So yeah, I think when you go back to a lot of classic sci-fi, there's, you know, we can talk about suspension of disbelief, but as an audience, there needs for you to connect with something. There sometimes needs to be conscious suspension of your, yes, temporal displacement to make some older fiction work.
Allow yourself to jack into the Neuromancer environment and then you will enjoy it.
All right, so we have Dasmi's recommendation for jacking in.
Would you recommend it?
Do I recommend the book, first of all? Yes, unequivocally. Since it is an early specimen of the genre, if you haven't read it yet, you are going to go through a lot of familiar territory. It is worthwhile to see the organization of the genre, and if you go in only expecting that, I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised, because it is a really durable book reaching to us in 2020. From 1984. So yeah, that's a definite thumbs up from me. Do I recommend the radio genre? Yes, with an asterisk. I think if you've read the book already or minimally read the Wikipedia summary, then a lot of the pleasure of this is seeing those characters that were previously performed with your inner monologue realized by actors who care about the production and are gonna add an interpretation that you're not familiar with. So yes, I recommend the radio genre, but with some preparation from the audience.
That makes sense. And I'm gonna order the book, because I do wanna compare. And I feel like, as someone who enjoys sci-fi and you know, grew up in the time when this book was written, I feel like I should read it. So I'm going to get it. I want to see what it's all about.
All right. So for a member of an audience that likes this story, what else do we recommend?
That's That's a good question. Well, this is totally off the genre and actually off the media format too. I recommend Sin City a lot. It's got the same narrative, the same gritty feeling, the same dystopian disconnectedness. It reminded me a lot of that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a totally different story, totally different everything, but that just kept coming to mind as Sin City when I was listening to it.
Okay.
I would recommend old, and I think we're going to review some of these coming up, but old sci-fi radio dramas from the 50s, 40s and 50s. Like there's a show called 2000 Plus, which it had some of that.
Which we definitely need to do an episode on. Yeah. Yep.
Anything like that, older sci-fi is fascinating because it has the same... So if you were in the 80s and you read this book, or let's say that you could listen to this drama and it was made in 84 and not 2000, whenever it was made.
2003.
Yeah. The technologies and the environments would seem so fantastic and so futuristic. And I think if you put yourself in that context when listening to something like 2000 Plus or old sci-fi radio dramas, I think the audience would have had the same kind of feeling listening to those as they would to Neuromancer. Yeah. I keep saying Necromancer, but that's very different.
Yes, it is.
And what would you recommend for a similar listening or reading experience?
All right. Well, this is actually part of a trilogy, the Sprawl trilogy.
Yes, it is.
There are two other books, Count Zero and Mona Lisa Overdrive, and I've actually not read them. Count Zero is now in the mail, so that's the next thing that I'm going to dive into. But not having read it yet, I can't really include that as part of my extended recommendations. So it's just my journey. Beyond that, it would be very simple for me to just give you my list of favorite cyberpunk titles, but that's not really doing a service to our audience of tens. And tens I think I listeners. Need to reach for deeper cuts. So this might be a little bit ridiculous, but Taxi Driver.
Really?
Taxi Driver. Well, hear me out. Taxi Driver is situated in an urban decay setting, and it uses the same, I'm going to say the same visual style, even though as a book or a radio drama, there is no visual style, but it's the same goddamn visual style, and the same character notes that illustrate the genre, because it's got all of that feeling of melancholy from the city, loneliness in a crowd, and the flavor of the plight is similar. It's Taxi Driver is actually a cyberpunk film just without smartphones.
I gotta think on that. I gotta mull that over, but I think I can see your point.
And I'm also gonna add Midnight Cowboy to that list.
I have not seen that.
Oh man, I'm gonna have so many jokes for you later. Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, shit, how do we wrap this up?
Go watch Taxi Driver and The Matrix and Sin City and Hackers, and and go play Spectre VR, and you'll pretty much have this summed up.
All right. And then you've still got Deus Ex, and I think there's another... Oh, Cyberpunk 2077 is coming out. So, hey, Dasmi, now that we're done here, do you think there's an augment that can help me jack on?
Yes, and I think you can get it shipped overnight with Amazon Prime. I'm sure that you can.
Well, there's our fade out riff right there. Okay.
Jacking on. Jacking on is more disturbing.
Okay, let's do it again then. So Dasmi, now that we're living in the future, do you think there's gonna be an augment real soon that will help me jack in?
Well, Snaked, there already is. If you go to adamandeve.com and use code Skippy.
There's a fade out.
50% off your first order with code Skippy at adamandeve.com. Thanks for listening. The Big Dumb Object is a production of Skippy. This week, we would like to thank Audacity for their excellent open source audio editor. which we use to record and edit every episode of The Big Dumb Object.